Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke. Don't do
if I had $1 million.
Well, welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allen, and we're on the board. SP Futures down 6, NASDAQ Futures down 54. Because we have the big Fed decision today. Could be the biggest one ever, as we say every month. I'm not sure if it is, but the big one. We're going to have Powell, and then Powell's even more of a lame duck after this, and we're going to get somebody good in there who's going to lower these rates. So there. But it looks like we're going to lower by a quarter point today, which I think the market is anticipating. A few people are talking a half. I don't think that's going to happen, but it might. We will see. Do we have Professor Kevin?
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing all right.
Is it possible for our friend Dr. Johnson to somehow send all of our friends some kind of a pill about this football thing?
No, I didn't see much yesterday.
I was getting a lot during the show from people.
That's because you were wrong on so many things.
I don't think I am, but that's okay.
Well, what's your big beef about this? I mean, because
I don't really have it. That's my point. I don't really have a beef.
Well, you sort of did about James Madison and Tulane.
I think that somehow nobody really wants. The reason why I know this, Kevin, because I've been guilty of it my whole life. Nobody really wants things to change. People want to hang on to stuff that they enjoyed their whole life. And when it changes, sometimes you just got to say, God, we're just in a different room, guys. We're just in a different room. And we have decided somehow or another, we're going to have 35 or 40 or 50 essentially professional teams that used to be college teams. And yet somehow we're going to hang on to this, you know, David can beat Goliath kind of crap and let... We got to include people in that aren't professionals anymore. That dog doesn't hunt. You're either in or you're out. Nobody would think in the way of inclusion that if you're going to have a bunch of heavyweight fighters, we're going to pick three of the best heavyweight fighters, but we're going to include the guy who just won the Golden Gloves. He doesn't belong there. I'm sorry. You're going to kill the guy. We're at the point where some of these teams do not belong paying others. I think. I'm just saying.
Well, why doesn't Tulane, for example, belong playing anybody else?
I have no idea what their budget and stuff is.
I get that, but it's not like you're playing, you know, the eighth graders against the
fifth
graders.
Okay, but why are we making them in the top two issues I have? They shouldn't be in the top 12 if they're not.
Well, right. they're not. Now let's go back to what.
So there's two things really. I mean.
Back to what the rules are and why the rules are. Okay, so the rule is for inclusion in the field of 12 is that the top five rated conference champions get in. Now, if one of the top five is rated number 20 or number 30, but they're one of the top five, they're in. Why do they do that?
I have no idea, and I don't think it'll last.
Okay, because you don't pay attention to things I send you.
I do pay attention. I know exactly why people want to include. I'm saying at some point you got to say we're just different.
Well, it's not going to last, and I think the article I sent you from Aaron Taylor outlined that pretty well. But as it stands now, you have two levels of Division One. You have the I'm going to call them 1A and 1AA. I think they call them FBS and FCS. FCS is the football championship subdivision. That is your schools like, you know, Eastern Illinois or, my goodness, you know, the Ivy League schools.
Well, it's got to be like Northern. It's got to be all those people.
Illinois. No, Northern is not in that lower division. Okay. And those teams have had a 12-team playoff or a 16, it's either 12 or 16. I think 16-team playoff.
You're the only guy who knows this. Well, where's Indiana State?
Indiana State would be at that lower level, I believe. I can't swear to that because I don't know every one of the 1As. But, in fact, I can pull that up while we talk. So
well, I mean, I just... But explain where you're going with this. I mean, I know where you're going with it.
Where I'm going with this.
No, what I'm saying, what do you suppose is the difference between the Toledo, Buffalo, that group, I guess, is considered higher level than the Eastern Illinois group. But what is the difference between the two groups, really?
I mean, what do you mean, what is
the difference? Well, I mean, in terms of budget, in terms of being able to recruit people, that kind of thing. I mean, I don't know the difference. I mean, I would think Miami of Ohio could recruit and pay a little more than Eastern Illinois, but I don't know how much.
Eastern Illinois is in a lower division. They're the ones that have had the 16-team playoff literally for decades. So they've been doing playoffs forever. And if I scroll down, that's the Big Sky Conference where Montana and Montana State are at the top of that. The Coastal Athletic Association, that's Rhode Island, Villanova, teams like that.
They're lower or middle? I'm going to say middle.
Lower Division One. Then you go to Division Two and Division Three, but these are Division, you know, this is your Division One. I'm going to call them Division One AA.
Okay.
They call them the Division One FCS, Football Championship Subdivision, because they've been doing playoffs forever. The higher.
So they're in the Notre Dame group, only lower.
No, they're not.
Well, I mean, they're in the same.
They are a division of their own.
Okay,
that's your North Dakota States and South Dakotas and teams like that. Okay, so that's one group, and that's, you know, Eastern Illinois is in there. They're in the Ohio Valley Conference, and so they're in there with Tennessee Martin and Tennessee Tech and Gardner Webb and Western Illinois and Tennessee State. You get the idea there. So that's all in its own division. Now you go to the bigger division, and that is where, you know, we're very used to the Big Ten, the SEC, the ACC, etc., and we know all of those are in the top division. There are, in fact, 130 teams in the top division, roughly. I didn't
so like them so all like up. Navy and Air Force, those guys, they're all in the top
Navy
division.
And Air Force are in there, but so is Conference USA with, you know, it has Kennesaw State and Western Kentucky and Louisiana Tech. And you have the two independents. You have Notre Dame and Connecticut. And you have the Mid-America Conference. That's your Western Michigan's, Ohio, Toledo, et cetera, Miami, Ohio. Mountain West, is Boise State is the champion out there, but New Mexico's in that one, UNLV, et cetera. Pac-12 is just two teams this year. They're reorganizing, picking up a bunch of teams from another, you know, combining forces. So,
but it also said it's all the states, right? Utah State, Washington State, Oregon State, all those guys.
That group. Then you get the SEC. You get the Sun Belt Conference. That's where James Madison and Old Dominion are, and you know, Marshall is a name you'd recognize out of that. Southern Mississippi is a name you'd recognize out of that. So that's the kind of group that is in the top division. So now let's circle back to the playoffs, and they say the top five rated conference champions in that group get in. Last year, that was Big Ten champ, SEC champ, ACC champ, and the Big 12 champ, plus one from a lower level, Boise State. And Boise State probably would have gotten in as an at-large team if they weren't a champion.
Yeah, they were real good for a while.
Yeah, they've been, and they were good. They won their league again this year. You know, they're still good, but they aren't rated higher than Tulane and James Madison. So now there's a reason for that. Is you can't have a playoff in the top level division and say only these 40 or these even 60 teams can get in, and none of the rest of you guys have a pathway in.
Okay, and then my whole point is, That was yesterday, and yesterday's gone.
Well, yesterday is gone, but the same construct exists.
Yeah, I get it. I get it.
As long as you have this top division, you cannot get away with excluding half of the teams. They're going to go to court. They're going to file a lawsuit. They're going to get a restraining order immediately, and they are going to win because you can't
say... Okay, well, that's according to who?
It's according to anybody, any legal analysis I have ever read on this.
Again, that was yesterday, and yesterday's gone. The new division...
Yesterday is only a little gone.
Well, that's the point. That's really what we're jousting about, Kevin, is how much of yesterday still exists, and that's really kind of the difference of opinion. My opinion is once you get down this road, you're gone.
Opinion. I think that if you are not too far off from seeing all the top level conferences split off and form their own division, or maybe even form something that is outside the jurisdiction of the NCAA.
I just as it comes to, you know,
you won't have your James Madisons anymore.
You know, you won't because to me, Kevin, you know, for whatever stupid reason, everybody has their own. My stuff is always kind of follow the money, and you kind of get there. I don't, somehow or another, despite what you just described, by the way, makes perfect sense to me in the sense that if everybody was doing things like they did it 15 years ago with some attempt at scholarships and those other kinds of things, I have no problem with this. I think it's fine, to be honest with you. All I'm saying is we aren't there anymore, bud. Somehow or another, we have got people with $40 million and $50 million budgets and other people with one thinking they still should be playing each other. It's almost like the difference in softball, Kevin, is you and I could be on whatever your team was or whatever our team was. We could be on that team. We could go play Let Us Entertain You, who got people jobs to be on the team. Okay, and the worst that could happen is it's 15-2 and it's the fifth inning and we go to the bar early. But in football, it's a little different.
Well, actually, we knocked them out of the Metro tournament.
Well, you can't because they had a million different guys playing a million different tournaments. You could do it. I mean, yeah, you can. But no. I don't...
Yeah, we did. We also, you know, knocked out the Whips, who were the defending national champions.
Well, we played them on a 6 o'clock on a Sunday morning somewhere, and we came damn close. But I don't think they had half of their guys either because they didn't want to get up at that hour. Figured they'd dust us off and they'd show up later, which they ended up doing, actually. But you know what I'm saying is where are we now? I mean, plus I don't really want, I try and follow this stuff through. I don't want, again, I got no problem with James Madison. I don't want a 38-point favorite that at that number should be off the board. And all of a sudden the Oregon coach is going, oh, bleep, we're only winning by 35 with 2 minutes left. We better start throwing the ball to cover this thing. All of a sudden, it just leads from one thing to another, I think. Just saying.
Okay, well, but that could happen in any matchup, right?
Well, you should have a 38-point favorite in a 12-team.
With two of the power conference teams and one of them's a 7-point favorite and it's a 6-point lead, we better get a field goal.
But I'm not big on 40-point games to start with. I don't want them being a major gambling event. I just don't like it. I mean, I don't think you do either. We're just kind of jousting.
No, but what I'm telling you is there is a reason that it's done that way.
I get it.
It would only be Tulane if Virginia had beaten Duke, because then Virginia would have been the higher-rated conference champion, and they would have gotten in, and Tulane would have gotten bumped out of it. But because Duke won, and they had five losses, because the ACC has a stupid tiebreaker system, and as a result, Duke wasn't one of the five top-rated conference champions. They probably weren't six or seven either.
Oh, no, they were. By the way, who did Miami lose to in the ACC?
Miami lost to Florida State and... hold on, I'll tell you. SMU, I think.
Those two teams weren't terrible, were they?
SMU wasn't bad. They're 8-4. But no, Florida State's terrible. Florida State's god awful. They were 5-7, and they were 2-6 in the conference.
I'm sort of at the point, and again, I keep picking on the one school. But if you were to show up at Oregon or Alabama or probably even Notre Dame today versus James Madison, you're going to find probably 10 to 12 people at one of those other places, getting a real salary, going over to Portal, making offers to people, doing all kinds of stuff. It's an absolute huge business. Where the other guys don't have anything like that. They might have a couple of... I'm saying they have distanced themselves. You didn't do it, I didn't do it, but it's pretty obvious, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I obviously, and the talent levels, the budgets that they have and the talent levels are different. It isn't really a size issue, though. I mean, you go look at James Madison, you can go look at Tulane. They're, you know, they have their 315, 320, 330 pound linemen across the offensive line. No problem. They all are, you know, work out in the same kind of weight rooms and all of that. So, they may not be as quick or as light on their feet as some of the guys on the other teams. They weren't necessarily as high level a recruit. Although, if you go down the rosters, you will find a lot of their guys are transfers from Power Conference schools who just decided they wanted to. They wanted to be starters somewhere, so they weren't in line to start where they were. So they were high-level recruits, but it's not that physical. That's why I said it's not the eighth graders playing the fifth graders, but it is teams with more talent playing teams with less overall ability. But physically, they're not. You know, it's not like they're beating up on a bunch of
just because you're 320 pounds,
40 blockers.
It is a football game, not a pie eating contest.
Yeah, I understand.
Well, the thing I still have a memory of, Kevin.
There's what, like, 13 Tulane players in the NFL right now. It's not like they don't get any talent.
I understand, but
that's the actives. That doesn't even count the practice squad players that they have, but and the injuries. You know, they got guys like Cairo Santos, it's from the Bears, the kicker, but they have Darnell Mooney, Dorian Williams, Oh my goodness! Well,
who was the all world defensive end? He's still playing. The Bears had him. He sucked, but now he's playing for somebody else. Khalil Mack from Buffalo, right?
Yeah, he's Khalil Mack from Buffalo. Famous Tulane alum was. Come on, played for the Bears for a long time. Really good halfback.
Tulane, wow. I don't remember so.
God, he's on TV all the time doing as an analyst, and I'm just blanking on his name.
Not Olson. The tight end? He wasn't from Tulane.
Matt Forte.
Who?
Matt Forte. Remember Matt
Forte? Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. Yeah.
Terrific football player.
Yep.
One of the...
I remember the TCU fiasco a few years ago. And, we talk about depth and so forth, and why people play these crummy teams, because most teams, these kids are 20 years old. They're not pro. They're not the Bears yet. And look at how much trouble the professional teams are having going through injuries and so forth. Most of these teams are decimated. I mean, that's the reason why the Bears are playing well. Their offensive line is healthy, and nobody else's is. You see, Phil Rivers got signed. He hasn't played.
Oh, yeah, since... He's like 44.
Yeah, but he. He hasn't played since 2020. He was eligible for the Hall of Fame next year. Now this resets the clock. He's got to wait another 5 years.
Yeah, and they're kind of screwed because in Indianapolis is, which is what this is about, and that's because their quarterback Daniel Jones got hurt. And their backup was Riley Leonard, the rookie from Notre Dame, who was never a great passer. He was a good runner, but not a great passer. And then on top of that, he's got an injury too. I think he can limp through games, but he can't do much. So they're kind of screwed. And I think they're in the I need any warm body.
Well, not so bad. They haven't even called us yet.
It's debatable whether we're warm bodies or not.
but I'm saying this is such a beat up job on these players, and the guys that don't make it on the field necessarily in college are not like the practice squad pros that actually are probably pretty damn good. The You know, this. Remember the TCU fiasco when all of a sudden these guys had this nice run? They made a couple of, they won a couple of big games. They had this, and they had this all-world running back, and they had somebody on defense that was, you know, they had some three or four really outstanding players, and they had, you know, other guys. And didn't the first playoff game or the second play, they won the first one, but didn't the running back and a couple of the other guys get hurt, and the next game they lost like 50 to 10 or something? I mean, there's just, now we're expecting these teams, you know, assuming, you know, same James Madison knocks off Oregon. Well, then they're not ready to play two more games against that kind of competition. You might luck off one time. You might, you know, nail Mike Tyson in the nose before he realizes that the fight has started, but it's not going to happen three times in a row, is it?
Probably not, you know, but it's interesting you bring up TCU because they're a Big 12 team. They're, you know, they're from the one of the power conferences. So they may not have the depth that some of the other teams have, but, you know, they would represent just as, you know, presumably as well as Texas Tech or Brigham Young or Utah or any of those teams.
But I'm trying to do, Kevin, I'm not trying to argue at all. What I'm trying to do is bring out the difference between what we're starting to asking these guys to do. Now, in the playoff thing, especially the teams that have a conference championship, nobody during the season, and by the way, the season is up to 12 games, which is kind of a lot, nobody plays four serious people in a row. If you do, it's kind of by accident. I mean, maybe you could in the SEC, but...
they don't play half of the teams in their league.
I'm saying maybe. My point is, now all of a sudden you're talking about almost a professional playoff run here. And it's really, really hard for a team to be able to do that, especially if anybody gets hurt along the way, is all I'm saying. And we're now talking to go all the way. It's your conference championship in, what, three games or four games? So it could be five in a row against the best competition in the country where nobody plays five games against the five best competition in the country all year, right? It's a whole different program, I think.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I think, look, Tom, you know, get back on the idea of the lower-level leagues. They can't be excluded now, but that doesn't mean that they won't be excluded at some. It's just going to require that all of those bigger schools split off on their own.
Which seems to be happening.
They will, but they haven't.
I'm with you. I'm just saying, in the immortal words of Jack Callahan, we don't know where we're going, but we're well on our way. Is that kind of described this?
Well, I think, you know, I think Aaron Taylor laid that out pretty well, and we should find a way to share that with our listeners. But,
why don't we get him on the show? I'd love to have Aaron Taylor on.
That'd be fantastic.
Tell everybody where Aaron Taylor is. He was a big star at Notre Dame, and he played for the Packers for a long time.
Played for the Chargers. He only had a six-year career. He started getting injured right away, and he had multiple injuries that ended his career, but now he's an analyst for I forget who.
He was a hell of a player.
He was a first-round draft pick and an consensus All-American type of player. He was terrific.
He was on the team that I went down to a national championship team under Lou Holtz. We played in the Fiesta Bowl. Went down. Who was the quarterback? Was Tony Rice, right?
Tony Rice, yeah.
That was one of the first games, Kevin, I ever, you know, I'd gone to a gazillion games, you and I, but that was kind of the first one that I remember being in the new era. What I mean the new era, it was a four-hour event. I'm sitting there going, good Lord. I couldn't even remember what happened in the first quarter. I mean, most, you know, they hadn't quite gotten to that stage yet, you know, but that was like the first one in the new the new commercial world, I guess. Hey, you know, the reason why I kind of bring this stuff up, Kevin, is maybe the only theme of the show is everything depends on everything else. And I look at what's happening in this pro, you know, or I guess pro college ball now, in the progression where it's going. I saw that happening in my industry, and I look at this IBM taking over this company yesterday that you and I were talking about going back and forth. And, you know, it's so weird when you see these things trying to pile together. Was it 6-8 weeks ago you sent out that? And I've talked on the show, and I don't follow IBM all that much, but I knew people that worked there years and years ago. But the stock has done nothing but go straight up for the last. It's got to be one of the quietest, best-performing stocks there are outside of the D7, the Magnificent Seven. And then you sent that thing out about how much money they were making and how much work they were doing in China, putting together essentially their national security operation to spy on their own people, which the article seemed to think was only there. I don't believe that for a second. But so they're making this money kind of overseas. And everybody thinks that in Trump's first term, when all the profit was overseas and people weren't paying the taxes, that he and his group caused people to repatriate some of that. And everybody thinks that he fixed the, quote, problem. Well, in fact, it's probably easier now to hoard money overseas than it was before he did that. Now, some of it came under the old rules, some of it came this way. So I'm not going to criticize that part of it, but what you're left with, I think, is if you maintain stuff overseas, you never have to bring it back, I think. Now, where's Bob Goldman when we need him? But I think that, you know, if you look at these guys, I'm thinking making a lot of money over in China doing this, probably are sequestering some of the dough there, and all of a sudden they were able to buy a firm for 30% higher than it was trading, a firm maybe other people wanted. Now, it doesn't just stop with, you know, it should be, if they get away with it in China, maybe it should be a big fat dividend to Kevin O'Neill that owns 1,000 shares, but that's not where it goes. It continues to go onward where you get to pick off other people. It's like the drug companies did their money overseas, were able to buy other smaller drug companies. It never ends where you think it's going to end, Kevin. And that's why I think you have to be very alarmed about where things are going while they're going before they get there. Is that a odd way of saying it?
Yeah. I don't know how alarmed I am about college football.
Well, I'm not either, but we obviously are friends and we care about it. I don't really want Notre Dame to be sold to a private equity firm like happened to, was it Utah yesterday?
Yeah.
I mean, what does that do to the tax deductibility? Is it still going to be tax-free? I mean, come on, where are we going? I mean, right?
Yeah, I don't believe it will be tax-free, but I don't think, you know, they already know that a whole lot of the NIL stuff is not tax-free, and they're making sure everybody knows that, because I don't think they want to get in hot water with that.
I think some of it, people still think it is.
No.
To who?
For the players. They have to pay taxes.
Well, they have to pay taxes, but, I mean, the people who contribute, I wonder how the group, I think they were an Ohio group that was trying to get people to control. Well, let's back up a second. I think there's a bunch of different levels in all this stuff, and that's why we keep talking about it. If there's a group that just wants to pay people for some school, I think somehow or another they have to be able to make some income, Kevin, because they might be able to call Kevin O'Neill and say, give us $100,000 for Notre Dame to pay people. I don't think you're going to do it every year, are you? I mean, there'd have to be some way where, if you take somebody to Pete's Pizza and he makes $500 for his 2 hours he was there, the number is going to have to be 7, because the place has to have, they got to make some kind of profit or else they got to go back to everybody again, right?
Yeah, without having the rules in front of me, there's a couple of different approaches to this. So part one is that the schools have a budget of, I think the max they can pay out is like 20.5, and that number is going to go up a little bit every year, but they basically have a payroll, and it's not just for football, I believe it's for all sports, so there's some limitations on how much they're going to pay everybody. I would imagine that a donation to that pool is probably still considered tax deductible.
I would agree.
Whether yep. It should be or not, I would imagine it is. Now, if I go independently, and the Stocks and Jocks Inc. decides it wants to hire Marcus Burton, basketball player for Notre Dame, as a spokesperson, because Marcus just is having surgery today and he's not going to play, so he's got time on his hands, then Stocks and Jocks Inc. would have a deductible marketing expense.
Correct.
Okay. But and Marcus Burton would have a taxable income burden.
Well, if the somehow, and I think boy, if it was me, this would happen tomorrow. If we wrote a check to Notre Dame, the general fund, I think that's tax deductible. If the football team is now a for-profit operation, I'm not so sure a check there becomes...
I would imagine not. So when you get to that private equity setup and you incorporate, you know, so that you can pull it off, yeah, I think then that's going to change the whole game.
Well, the one group set up as a was a charity for essentially hospitals, and so the players would do, I don't know, it was just football players, but they would go to the hospital and it was a cancer institute or something and talk to the kids, and which is really pretty nice. I think they were paying the players like $500 an hour to go, you know, to go 2 hours three nights a week or something. So clearly the $500 to the player is taxable. The question is our group that does this, are we considered a charitable organization? I mean, any charitable organization, if you pay somebody a check, if they're an employee, they have to pay taxes, right? I mean, Notre Dame, the professors have to pay taxes, correct?
Oh, yeah. If you're the CEO or you're a low-level worker at any 501c3, your income is taxable.
Yeah. So it's kind of all this stuff sort of has to play out somehow. I mean, and everybody's trying, I'm sure, nudging their way through every lobbyist in the world about hanging on to that tax deductibility to the last possible second, I would think. I mean, because right now, I don't know why. I have no idea whether, say, Indiana has an amusement tax. I know Illinois does. So if Northwestern plays a football game, I don't think the city or the state can collect the amusement tax on the tickets, which to me is, I'm not so sure about that, Kevin. Are you?
I don't know if they can or can't.
I don't think they can. Well, Northwestern Hospital, don't tell me they don't make money. They don't pay any taxes, property taxes or otherwise. I don't even think they paid a water bill, which is even more bizarre if that's true. Hey, I got a question for you. I met with a former contributor to the show, Stephanie Koenig, last night, who now works at McDonald's and has an adorable young girl. That's the reason why she had to quit Stacks and Jacks.
I remember when she had the baby. Yep.
Yeah, well, Steph's terrific.
Got to be like 5 years old now, huh?
I think she's pushing six, yeah. Okay. She's a beautiful girl and really pleasant. Well, Steph's the best. And so I got one for you. How many eggs does McDonald's use per year just in the U.S.?
Oh, God, I couldn't even begin to guess.
Would help if I said if you put them end-to-end, it would go around the world like twice or something like that. Like 3 billion just in the U.S. Is that wild?
Yeah, and they still don't know how to cook them without making them taste like rubber.
Well, it's... Maybe that's where they want everything to taste. But she was just down in Argentina and said it's really interesting because one of their things is they want everything sourced kind of locally. And when you get into other countries, it gets harder and harder to do. Plus, all their eggs worldwide are cage free. I didn't know that. Hmm. I'm pretty impressed with that. So they all get along. Actually, chickens don't really get along. Maybe you cause fights by doing that. But anyway, they're all cage-free.
If everyone's got along and started organizing, we're all screwed. We're not getting any eggs.
Yeah, so when we had a big debate last night, we heard it be like two other guys about, do you need a rooster? Shows you how much city guys have no idea. But evidently they start laying eggs even without a rooster or something. I don't know, because... All these places now in the burbs here, you get to have chickens, but you can't have a rooster because it wakes people up too early. I wouldn't mind it. I'm up before the rooster probably, but I guess other people get pissed off.
Yeah, your job would be to wake the rooster so the rooster can wake everyone else.
Yeah. But evidently, how's that for a conversation? But anyway, Steph says hello to everybody. She hopes someday back she can be on the air with us, either as a guest or something. I think I had her talked into that last night about how Argentina was doing. You know, I really like getting the views of people like John Lee and people that are actually in these places. When Lou was telling us all about his trip to, where did he go? He went on the lower Danube, right? And he stopped in all those different countries and was telling us who was doing well and that. I love listening to that, don't you?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess someday it might cause somebody to invest someplace or not or whatever. But, hey, what do you, I know we don't talk about this too much. I'm sure we'll be all over it with Russell or Larissa or both or whoever on today. What do you make all this Fed maneuvering here, Jan, and this idea? Every once in a while, you know, we've been doing the show for a long time, every once in a while, it seems like we, some people on the show discover some stuff that maybe we all should have known for 10 years. And I, the last couple of months, between the veteran stuff and the work Hal has done, and actually some of the articles you've come up with, the work Hal's done since he's gotten these two new classes, History of Economic Thought, I'm almost tempted to go back and read some of the stuff from Karl Marx. Because didn't he pretty much turn everything we thought a little on its ear a little bit the last couple of weeks?
Oh, did Hal?
Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit, I think. I don't know that anything has necessarily changed in my opinions. It's just a little bit of a retelling of history, and maybe a more accurate retelling of history. So, I think it's great for that, but it doesn't really change the fact that that when we're looking at, and I've known all a lot, as you talked about banking and access to credit, I know there's more access to credit locally. For small businesses, despite the fact that they're getting their butts kicked nationally, that you get away from the major money centers and you probably have a little bit more ability, because there's really a thriving small business community in places like where I live. But that doesn't mean that if you talk to the bankers, they don't say it's just a monumental pain in the butt to do compliance nowadays. And the problem with that is that if you're trying to accomplish, if you're trying to do compliance on your loan portfolio, it's exactly what you guys have described. You might as well make one, do compliance once for a big corporation, and then 25 times for small corporations to have the same impact on your portfolio. But it does create also risk with that, and so. Now you got to manage the risk of having all your eggs in fewer baskets.
Were you still there when they went from the
eggs? Speaking of eggs,
yeah, you weren't, but you weren't still in the business. That business when you when they went from the reserve requirement to the capital requirement, were you?
No, absolutely not.
Do you think a current money and banking course teaches the capital one, or still teaches the old way?
Don't know, haven't looked at it. I did actually, talk to people about teaching it, talk to some of the local banks about teaching it, but I never pulled up the course to see what the course content looked like. We didn't get that far.
I'm gonna bet that the capital requirements for one of the banks you're talking about and a money center bank are totally different.
On a percentage basis, or
I hearken back to Robert telling me how, and Robert was a big push for this, that you're this is all I know, my world wasn't necessarily in a clearing corpse, but I knew about them and knew people that were there, and I know how they work, that if Board of Trade Clearing or OCC, Option Clearing Corp, has a big chunk of change overnight, all of a sudden this is before COVID, 4 or 5 years, I don't know when this all happened. Actually happened in 2008, but maybe it didn't work its way through too long, but you couldn't drop $300 million on a bank at night because it screwed up their capital requirements. And I remember joking on the show going, what good is a bank? They don't give loans and you can't give them money. I mean, really, what good are they? Robert told me that Jamie Dimon himself, if somebody wanted to drop $400 or $500 million, somebody wouldn't be us. And J.P. Morgan overnight, that was considered fast money. He was liable to leave the next day. And J.P. Morgan needed a big dose of capital to accept it. So Jamie Dimon would have to approve it personally. And that's how the exchanges then became exchanges. These clearing corps ended up with an input into the Fed. They could drop it right into the Fed. They have a window at the Federal Reserve, which you never would have thought needed to be happening 20 years ago. You'd say, what the hell? Just put it in the bank.
You wouldn't, except that when you start changing the rules, then it starts cascading through with a lot of additional requirements.
That's kind of been the theme of what we've talked about for years, right, Kevin? Once you start going down some road, if you don't know where the hell you're going, who knows where you're going to end up, right?
You don't know where you're going, but you'll get there quickly.
Yeah, and so it's like, now, should any of this stuff be walked back in today's political world? Can anybody, this is probably a Lou question or maybe a John Flanagan question. I seem to recall, Kevin, when we were in, certainly when I was in grad school, there was a, I thought that there was some sort of, I won't say a law, some sort of a convention that with any big bill that got passed, there was a word for it that I can't remember, that in 6 months, 12 months, 18 months or whatever, there was a review of whatever that bill was supposed to do to find out if it actually was doing what it was supposed to do, and people would have a chance to change it, tweak it, whatever you want to call it. I haven't heard of that in 40 years, have you? They just let it out there and oops, it was supposed to, the tax cut was supposed to do this, it's not doing it, oh well, just let it go. I mean, there doesn't seem to be a review on anything, does there?
Or we'll just make changes, we'll leave it in place, but then we'll make these other changes, and if you were to plot that, if you were able to plot that, it would never look linear. It would look like, it would look like spaghetti.
Yeah. So I mean, a lot of this, where Fed meeting, what do you think's going on there? What do you think of the change with the new guy coming in, and now people are bitching about they don't want Trump's guy in there, they want somebody else in there, which would be Trump's guy, but they don't like, what's his name? The economic guy, what's his name? Bessent or something? No, Bessent's
in line. I don't think Bessent's in line for it.
No, anyway. Who's the economic guy? The economic advisor guy. The guy with the glasses, what the hell's his name? He's supposedly the anointed one, but now people are saying maybe not him, but keeps kind of going back and forth. Boy, Powell, if he wanted to, could really upset the whole mess. I don't think he will, because he doesn't have to resign as a board member. If he doesn't, the new choice has to come from somebody already on the board. I don't think he will. I don't think anybody's ever done that. But his term as his chair is up in May, but his term on the board is another, what, 2 years?
Something like that, yeah.
But I think he wants out. Just saying, but...
Well, it depends on... He may very well want out, but he may, want to give the finger to Trump, too, and that would be a way he could do it.
Yeah, those guys don't make very much. They make there's a lot of people at the Fed make more money than the board.
Yeah, well, it depends on, depends on what his priorities are.
Yeah, I don't, so we're going to drop the quarter point, which I don't think is going to, well, why do you think, I don't know if you listened yesterday, but I'd have no problem with any of this stuff, Kevin, if somehow or another, and one of the things I have against Powell is he dropped the rates from what? At one point, four and a half down to like zero. How could he be oblivious to the fact that no credit card rates went down at all? And yet you have 100 swinging idiots tomorrow going to be all over the radio and TV telling you how your credit card rate's going down, and it doesn't. Why do we try and keep people ignorant on this, or why don't people recognize it or see it? I don't get it.
Well, and you watch this stuff more than I do, but I don't know that I've heard anybody saying credit card rates will go down, but they. What they will tell you is that mortgage rates will go down. That's always the big, the big lure, and to some extent they do. But that doesn't mean anybody who's got a fixed rate mortgage is going to go down. It just, I suppose if you have a variable, then that's happening.
Well, the last, there's been three rate cuts now or two. I think there's been three. I think the 10-year is exactly where might even be a little higher than when they started doing that. And the mortgages come off the 10-year, right? Pretty much?
Probably, yeah. Come off at something longer term.
I feel weird about this because you and I went through this before, and we can see how this happens. By lowering the risk-free rate, is what you want to call it, from wherever we're at, you could conceivably, if people thought that that's going to goose the inflation a little bit, your long-term rates could actually go up, not down. Everybody thinks, if you listen to those stuff, that the Fed controls the rates all along the way. They don't. They control the amount of money in the pool today, tomorrow, next week, next month, 6 months from now. They control the short-term rates by adding or subtracting money from the pool, so that's the inner bank rate at night moves up and down. That's what they do. Which, by the way, it's pretty hard to do. I mean, it's a pretty serious job. By the way, Mike says Hassett is the economic advisor. Hassett. It's a very serious job. But when you talk about long-term rates, They don't control them. The way they were able to do it during the COVID is, even though inflation ran up, they went and bought the simplest trade. Well, so timing is everything, right? But the simplest trade since I started, when I started, the Dow was 800. If you would have no money in the market there and somebody would have given you $1 million, it was pretty obvious the only way the market could go is up, unless we were going to fold as a country. Well, when the Treasury rates were real high here, when the Treasury rates were, I'm going to say, when the bonds got high, when the rates got down real low, it was the biggest sucker trade on earth, Kevin. Except every time they started to go down and rates went up, the Fed went out and bought the stuff. So you'd sell, you could short them thinking they were going down, which they were. All of a sudden, the Fed had come and buy them. So you got rolled over by the steamroller. So that's why your Fed balance sheet went from like $2 trillion to like 7 or 8. They went and bought like $5 trillion worth of stuff to keep the long-term rates low. Well, nobody's ever done that before, and I don't know if anybody could really do it again or, get away with it, because they did it worldwide. I mean, why do you think interest rates went negative in Europe? You and I would never do that. Can you imagine, Kevin, if your lovely mom gave me money to manage, and the first thing I did was go buy a bond where she lost money on it? I think Ray would say, "Kevin, is your friend an idiot or what?" why would anybody do that?
I'd be forced to say yes.
Yeah, I mean, why would anybody do that? And by the way, take a fee for doing it. I mean, the only people dumb enough to do that is a government, right? Why would you? Anyway, could you imagine? Yeah. Why do you think people over in Europe probably said, "This isn't going to last"? I'm going to sell these bonds. Guess what? You just got to ram where the sun don't shine. As the government bought them from you at negative interest rates? How would you ever even anticipate that?
Anything we did during all that COVID nonsense? Is there anything we did that wasn't damaging?
No, it appears not. Although I suspect,
I'm with Hal that as we look at it, it's too consistently. There's too much evidence that it's been done on purpose, because it's been done repeatedly.
I would don't tell me you're finally starting to. My brother still refuses to believe that. He still thinks that.
I get it, and Dan's a good soul, and he's got a way of seeing the best in people. So, I salute that. But we can't be that wrong that often. I just find it hard to believe. And just go back, go read The Great Reset. I know I sent you a copy.
Yeah.
There's a lot in there that just says right there, for public consumption, in writing, tells you exactly what the thought process process is behind all of this stuff. And, it's very on purpose.
I could sit down with, if they ever came back to...
Stuff.
We have to go over to the other, go to Russell here in a sec, but I could sit down with my Fed dudes and some really serious economists, I'm going to say maybe even Russell and Hal, and I will lob out there, because I was there, Kevin. I watched this all day long. I was either in school or right afterward, where I still was going to lectures even after I graduated. I think Paul Volcker, the hero of the monetary world, I think Paul Volcker put savings loans out of business on purpose. Because the big banks didn't want them competing, because they wanted to start having checking accounts and other kinds of stuff. He put them out of business, and I think we still, as a nation, have not recovered from that. But now, does anybody believe me? Maybe you. I don't know.
I can't look back on that era, and, I don't remember it as well, even though I was involved in some diligence looking at SNL properties, but so you're a little more steeped in that, but I'm saying it would be consistent with what we've seen over the years, and everything is done in the name of, we're going to help the little guy, and we never help the little guy. We it always goes the other way. So we are either really, really stupid, and there is a certain amount of stupidity, because people think government is going to be the solution to all kinds of things, and where it can't be the solution. So you know, I'm sure there is a certain amount of that that isn't intentional and is just too damn stubborn to ignore the people who lay out what the consequences are going to be. And, you know, we saw that with Obamacare. We saw that with Dodd-Frank, that there were a whole lot of people who said, here are going to be the consequences of what we do. And it just got ignored because, you know, either we're just evil and we have evil people who are, you know, who know darn well what the consequences are going to be, but they proceed because it's going to serve a constituency, or they're stupid people who just are so stubbornly wed to an ideology that they can't see it any other way.
I'll try and be somewhat. Can I be generous here for a second, Kevin? I think people are so focused into getting their own essentially crap out of one of these bills. Maybe they don't consciously realize how much it's going to hurt other people, but maybe they don't care either. I mean, my whole thing with Obamacare is you know, I mean, I'll debate with anybody on it. I didn't think it was a very good bill to start with for two reasons. One is I think you needed to get somebody from the other side of the aisle to agree that it was a good idea, or else you're going to be locked into the next 40 years of one side saying it sucks, the other guy's defending it, when in fact the answer is probably somewhere in the middle. And so that my prediction, unfortunately, has played out there. And the other one was they didn't deal with any of the cost stuff, which was a suicidal thing in the first place. But now my question on both sides of people, one group seems comfortable picking at it, and the other group seems comfortable defending it, and obviously it needs to be changed. And it's been, what, 30 years?
Actually, I don't think that we have anybody defending it anymore. They aren't attacking it, but when you're sitting there advocating for basically an indefinite extension of subsidies because people can't afford insurance, I think that is a very tacit admission that it doesn't work and it's no good.
Well, why can't we fix it?
Well, yeah, and actually, you know, one of the things that's coming out of the Trump administration is the idea that, you know, let's just give the money to people, let them use a health savings account to pay for insurance, which you can't do right now, but let them, you know, funnel it that way. Geez, I wrote that in 2010.
I used to have one of those. That's not a new idea, but the thing of it is, the stuff's gotten so expensive.
It's a new idea in that you would be able to pay your insurance premiums out of it. So, in other words, it's a way to give people the tax-free ability to tax-free get the tax benefit that the corporations get from providing insurance plans, but for you to shop for your own.
Kevin, you and I have been talking about that for how many people do you know?
I understand that, and I also said, you know, people who are on like Medicaid or something like that, instead of paying for Medicaid, they get an HSA too, and they get to shop because they may be down economically, but that doesn't mean they're too stupid to shop for something that in their own interest. So maybe you're better off spending some money educating people on how insurance works.
Well, I think
so. Anyway, that's a longer discussion, and
we got people hanging.
And this are in, so
no, they're both all great. All right, Kevin, thanks, bud. I you know what? Having said, I have all this big debate. I actually thought the Irish might have a team to do something this year. I thought nobody really wanted to play them at this level. I think it would have been interesting.
I have no doubt that they are better than the fifth best SEC team.
I think they're a lot better than Miami right now either, but I also think that head-to-head is an easy way out.
I don't think it ever should have been a discussion of Notre Dame versus Miami for the last spot. It should have been a discussion of, you know, is it Notre Dame versus Alabama, Notre Dame versus Oklahoma, somebody like that. And look, Alabama's closing statement, their closing 3 weeks, beat up Eastern Illinois, barely squeaked by Auburn, who was playing with an interim coach because they sucked bad enough to fire their head coach, and then to play terribly in the SEC championship. And this idea that the championship game shouldn't matter and it shouldn't drop a team is stupid, because they did drop Brigham Young for losing in their championship game, but they didn't drop Alabama. You know, guess who the chairman is for the committee? It's an SEC.
I listen
SEC
to my
athletic director.
One of my non-favorite people, Saban, say that when you play in one of those games, you play somebody above you, and you lose like you're supposed to. Now, they didn't look very good. I agree with you on that.
If you lose, they weren't competitive. That's the problem.
Okay, but he said if you lose like you're supposed to, it's hard to imagine dropping below two teams that didn't play at all. And he has a point there.
Well, the two teams that didn't play at all managed to, one of them managed to drop without playing at all.
Yeah, I know.
There's a lot of stupidity in this process. And, I think that's the complaint. But as I said, it's five SEC teams in there. This was brilliantly played by them. As long as they insisted that it was a Notre Dame Miami matchup for the last spot, then that kept the SEC out of the discussion. And of course, they're the SEC. They're great.
Well, yeah.
And therefore, they get five teams in. They should have had four.
What's your answer to the question?
Miami could both be in.
Is Russell going to get us into a skybox at the Indiana game?
Be damn well better.
I got myself into one for Saturday's game, but I don't know if my daughter's going to give up her seat for the national championship to you guys.
if you had a skybox, you'd have all kinds of seats.
Yeah, well, if it's not your skybox, you only get a couple of slots. There's no way I'm taking either of you to that game because you're just going to bitch about Notre Dame should be there the whole time.
I didn't even go out and buy a cardigan.
I actually got a laugh out loud from the kitchen on that one.
You
guys bitching about the Notre Dame thing. Yeah.
Russell, I will tell you that from now, as the way things shook out, John F. Kennedy, ich bin ein Indiana Hoosier.
Me too.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of Notre Dame folks are on our side, at least for the next 3 or 4 weeks. And as far as the college football thing goes, I don't think I really would have even been watching toward the end of the season if Indiana hadn't been good. That's how much I feel like they've ruined it.
I'm with you.
And I grew up, keep in mind, I grew up in the South, where we didn't really have, we didn't care about NFL at all.
Yeah, I understood that.
Especially Memphis was like the biggest city that was the farthest from any NFL team. There were some funny stats about, and everybody in Memphis was Cowboys fans, for goodness sakes. My point was the Southern college football, that was our NFL. But you got to figure once ESPN became the SEC's bitch, that this is just what you're going to hear forever.
And that's what
has happened. That's ABC. When ABC, this is the first year that ABC ESPN has been the primary for SEC. What the heck else did you expect? They got a guy looking like a praying mantis on there that does nothing but say how great the SEC is and how terrible everybody else is every time they talk about college football. Feinbaum guy. And I'll tell you what, I went to high school with that guy, and he got beaten up so much at the private school I went to, he had to go to a public school. He's a wimp. He's a wimp.
Well, so get him.
Well, yeah. that's the big reason that Notre Dame turned down the bowl game, too, is, ESPN's on-air people trashed him for the last month. And then they said, okay, we want to have a feature of the first two teams out. And, nobody's going to pay attention to the damn Pop-Tarts Bowl unless they can promote it like that. And I think Notre Dame said, you will get that promotion. You ain't getting it from us.
We have a guy on this show that reminds me a lot of this, Kevin O'Neill. It said, as soon as this playoff started 5 years ago, Kevin, you said they should just bleep can all the bowl games. What's the point of having the Irish go play Texas with all the seniors sitting out just so you can have another couple of weeks of these other bowls are useless.
You don't even get that. Think of what, the Pop-Tarts Bowl that they wanted them to go to is on the 27th of December. Do you think they're going to have heavy practices this week? No. They might do some workouts and maybe some stuff in helmets and shorts. Next week's finals week, so there's not going to be much structured. They're going to have, a lot of small group weightlifting, come over when you can, that kind of stuff. Then they go home for Christmas for a couple of days, and then Christmas night they'll fly over and so that they can have a workout on the 26th that's not going to be that's not going to involve any serious practice. It's going to be a walkthrough and for the next game, and then they'll play the game on the 27th. And so this canard that people keep throwing out there, you're missing out on a lot of practice, is just nonsense.
And beyond that one, I'm sorry to talk over you, but beyond that one, why the hell would you want extra practices when 60% of your team's not going to be there next year? That's advantage of, well, the advantage that you used to get of those extra getting together at, you know, in December. I feel like if there's so much turnover now that's not really an argument to keep yourself in the ball.
Ask a coach, though, Russell. They die for the 2 weeks of practice because they want their...
Oh, I know they would.
They want their people for next year. It's essentially another spring practice.
Yeah, yeah. No, it really, it was one of those things that kind of, before we had the playoff, that would separate the haves and the have-nots, because, you know, the haves would get, some of them would get an extra month together.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, and I went to a have-not, having gone to Memphis, where I don't think we had a single winning season in the 6 years I was an undergrad.
Russell, though, it was a month. You were done Thanksgiving weekend, and then you might play your bowl game in January or at the end of December, so you did have a month, so you could have real practices and do development work with your young guys and all that. That's out the window. That doesn't exist anymore.
No, it doesn't. I always felt like that was a benefit of a bowl.
What percentage of all these bowls, there's still going to be a whole bunch of them, what percentage of them make any money for the school? Don't you have to hit up the alumni for like 15,000 tickets and stuff?
I know Memphis would lose money on loses money on some of the bowls that they have to go to as an obligation for the conference.
That's because if you don't sell the tickets, the school has to buy them, right?
Exactly. And like the Big 12 is fining the teams that opted out of bowls $500,000. You got to figure that it would have cost them more than $500,000 to go to the bowl.
Yeah, so they're actually making a financial decision. I'll pay you the $500,000.
Yeah. So
that's bizarre.
There you go.
Yeah, right, Kevin, thank you, bud.
You always get me all fired up on the college football team, having been a have not.
Well, I mean, I'm not so sure about your. We might have to fact check your farthest away from a. Are you farther away from a pro team?
It was like east of. And we're talking about like the 70s, okay? All right. When I was growing up. And it was like east of the Mississippi. Over $500,000 people, farthest from an NFL team, because St. Louis and New Orleans were the closest NFL teams.
I would have picked,
and they were both about 300 miles away.
I would have picked Lincoln.
But maybe. That's not east of the Mississippi,
right? But that's a state where the entire state, all they care about is Nebraska football. They don't.
Yeah,
there's nobody else. There's,
There's a lot of that upper Midwest stuff as
well.
Oh
God, yeah.
You know, there are just parts of the country that. We're not, you know, the NFL wasn't that big of a deal. I mean, now it is in Tennessee. They, you know, now that they have the team that's in Nashville, the people in Memphis follow the Oilers, or what do they call them now? The Titans, pretty closely.
Well, if you're in Wisconsin, half your closet is the bright red of Wisconsin, and the other is the green and yellow. What do you suppose the closet looks like? That's got to be a clash, don't you think?
It's very much of a clash. You know, I think yeah, and I mean, fashion-wise, you know, in Illinois, we can wear the same thing for our college games and our pro games.
Yeah, pretty much same.
And
same
in
colors.
Wisconsin, you know, how do you make that red and green look good together?
You
maybe around Christmas time.
You have to have two classes.
I will see you next Friday. I'll see you, Tom.
Yeah, well, if you're in a trailer, you need a double wide, one side for the Wisconsin and one side for the Green Bay.
Exactly. Larissa, you want to get in on this ragging on Green Bay Packer fans?
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the Packers fans.
I
don't like the colors scheme together. I think their uniforms are quite ugly. And I know it's irrelevant to the actual football playing, but I don't think they're attractive.
They're like the Oakland A's of the same colors, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, and I also want to say right now in my house, my 8-year-old is rebelling against me and has become a Packers fan. And my little guy then jumped on the 8-year-old's bandwagon. Oh, and God. He was like, okay, I'm going to be a Packers fan. And then he looked at me and I said, okay, well, I'll put away your jerseys, your Chicago Bear jerseys then, you know, so that you can be a Packers fan. And he looked really sad at me and he said, Mama, I still want to wear the jerseys. And I looked at him and I said, is it because the Bears are cuter? And he says, yeah, I need to be a wear the Chicago Bears jerseys.
Larissa, my first four years in Pee Wee League and Little League, every team I was on, we had the Oakland A's colors. God, did they suck. They're the same as the Packers, aren't they? The same color, green and
pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
I know we're off on a weird tangent, but a couple of years ago, there was a Little League, in somewhere up in New England, and they did the typical assigning Major League Baseball team names. And apparently some kid's team quit because they got to sign the Yankees.
Oh, that's funny.
Or no, they are like they bought the new uniforms and changed the name or something. But, you know, then all the kids burst into tears because they were right outside of Boston. They found out they were going to be the Yankees for the year.
Well, one thing you have to say nice about the Packers is, if there is one thing, they were, you used to actually own the team. Way back
in it's the community's team, man. Yep. And I think that's great.
Well, it was owned or run by the Knights of Columbus, and now it's actually run by Packers Charities. The people who buy the shares, you don't get a share in the team. You get a certificate to put on the wall. You have no dividend rights, no ownership rights, no ticket rights, no nothing except for a piece of paper. All you're doing is contribute to the team. But essentially, they are run by charities, as opposed to the McCaskies. Which would you rather have, the McCaskies or a charity? Duh.
That's true. That's funny. I was talking to a NASCAR team years ago. It was like a single team that needed funding, and I showed them what the Packers had done. You know, as far as having, you know, basically being community owned. And, you know, NASCAR people are so crazy. You'd love to, I'm sure there are a lot of guys in the grandstands would be like, that's my car down there.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, even though they, you know, have contributed $100 towards it.
Do you have any idea the history? I should know this. I mean, listeners might be new to her. Because our buddy Dr. J got caught in the, the game last Sunday was flexed. It was supposed to be 12 o'clock. And they moved it to 3:30. But I'd really like to go to a game at Lambeau Field. But I really only want to go to a noon game. I don't want to go to a night game in the tundra. I don't want to go to 3 o'clock. At least want the sun up. I don't know if it makes that much difference. But so somewhere along the line, way back, and I don't know how this started, but Milwaukee used to get some of the games. I don't know if you remember that, Larissa.
Yeah, they did.
County Stadium would get it. I think it was 2 out of the 7. It might have been 3, but I think it was 2. It might have been 3. If somebody knows, please text me. But and the other 4 were in Green Bay. All the playoff games were always in Green Bay. So now all the games are in Green Bay, but the people from Milwaukee that had the 2 or 3 teams, if you're still alive, I don't know if you could pass it on to your kids, they still get those games up in Green Bay. Now, whether there's
30,000... You like a partial season ticket? All
yeah, but no, whether there's 30,000 left of those people or 20 or 10 or 5, I don't know. But so Dr. J, our buddy John Najarian, he wanted to go to a Packer game, so he drives up there, and the game got flexed. I don't know if it was to a 3 o'clock or to a 7 o'clock.
Goodness.
And he's there, and he has a nice time and everything, but his idea was him and his lovely bride are going to drive home. Well, at 3:30 or 4, that's okay. It's probably a 3 or 4 hour drive. And, all of a sudden, he goes, everybody's leaving at once. They get on, was it Route 41, goes to Green Bay to Milwaukee. He goes, it is like the Dan Ryan all the way to Milwaukee. He goes, it was one of the games where the people from Milwaukee came up to Green Bay. He says, that game should never be flexed. He goes, because everybody leaves at once. They're all on the road at the exact same time. He goes, it was brutal. He got home at like 1 in the morning or something. He was not happy. But he goes, I forgot to ask if that was one of the Milwaukee games. It was my own fault. I should have checked on it, but he didn't. I don't know if it's 2 or 3, but it's, and I don't know how many of those people are left. You know, there can't be too many. We're talking.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
Because remember when in Dick Butkus's book, they talked about playing an exhibition game in County Stadium. And how Halas hated Lombardi so much, he made Butkus and Buffon play the entire game in the rain, an exhibition game. And they had these old crummy jerseys. Louis, you love this. Doug and Dick Doug Buffon and Dick Butkus. I was a pretty good friend of Doug Buffon's when he was on the trading floor. Nice guy. I didn't know Butkus at all. But anyway, they took their jerseys off and dropped them on the scale. It was like 20 pounds.
Oh, goodness.
because they were, I don't know what they were, heavy cotton or something, and they were just, because we're running around in this in the mud, you know, way before the season even started, because Hallis didn't like Lombardi. But you couldn't write fiction like this. But, yeah. All right, listen, what's going on with the Fed today? What's going on with everything here? What are we doing with the rates? Have you been following Hal's work on this last couple of weeks? He's been first, he was writing a thing on history of economic thought. I think we talked about this last time he ran, and he's talking about he's got a whole different view of Karl Marx now, because the stuff that Marx was railing about, you know, and he happened to name it communism. He was actually fighting against, you know, kind of a same sort of crony capitalism or plutocracy that we're heading towards here, where a few people control all the dough and, you know, big companies, and we're up their ass, their nose up the ass of government. He goes, that was exactly what doesn't make Karl Marx our hero or anything. He said, but what he was fighting against was really almost the same sort of system that we're kind of moving to, or maybe Europe actually has. But now in the next class he's teaching, he's talking about there's some banking in there, and he was digging through somebody's work on, and I tell you what, I could take a test today probably from one of you learned professors and reserve requirements and those things. I bet I would pass. I would have any idea what these new capital requirements and stuff are in the last however many years, 10 years. And he's that some classes they're still being taught the old way. And he's talking about these capital requirements that banks now have, and no reserve requirements that Greenspan snuck in the bill, the Save America Act, or whatever it was after the 2007. He says that absolutely buries small firms unless you have some small bank in the neighborhood, because the capital requirements on $1 billion loan is so much less than, you know, 100 smaller loans. It's scary. I never even knew that. I mean, and he says, no wonder middle America is getting carved out. It can't get any capital. I don't know if you've even thought of that, but I hadn't. I didn't know that the capital requirements were that much different, other than the fact that the exchanges now have a window in the Fed. Russell knows more about that than me. But do you think it's as serious as Hal thinks it is?
You know, it's interesting. I think the justification for this is because that larger loan is going to have a lower credit risk. And so this is how they're justifying it. But that creates a unique loop then, because how do you get to a higher level loan to justify that you are credit worthy? And I think it's a unique way of controlling who has access to capital then.
It does. It seems a little nefarious, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, essentially, this particular change combined with Dodd-Frank has essentially buried the middle class from a financing area. And this, what Hal's kind of concluding as he's going through this, and, I don't know, you think he's going, what do you think?
Well, I think it wasn't a nefarious idea to begin with. I think the justification was looking at credit and credit quality, particularly as Dodd-Frank was coming out, because that was something that we really struggled with, because we had all these loans that really weren't credit worthy. And it's how do you justify credit quality for some of these smaller loans? And I think until some of that's revisited, this will continue to be a problem.
Well, banks are supposed to have loans that they lose money on, right?
Well, I don't think anybody wants to lose money.
No, but I'm saying if you've got 100 small loans in the neighborhood, to not lose money on any of them means you're, I think you could make an economic case that you're being too stringent.
Maybe, but again, I think these banks are looking really to protect their assets and look to increase their overall revenue. I don't know that it was necessarily started out to be as nefarious as it sounds. It just ended up going in that direction, if that makes sense.
I think you're in the camp with the president of PTI Securities, my brother Dan.
Okay.
Which is
like
interesting. I used to be in that camp where when I see this stuff happening since I was very young, and it always seems like at the end of the day, this, oops, we never could have seen this happening, but it just seems to always benefit the same people. After a lot of years of watching this stuff, I'm kind of in, wait a minute, we don't flip the coin to get eight tails in a row necessarily. Somebody had to be in the front end, because the same people always seem to land on their feet and some don't. And I'm getting very, grumpy or conspiratorial about the whole thing, as I guess. And you and my brother still are not. Kevin's kind of with me now, believe it or not. Just saying.
Well, and again, I think it's played out that way. But I don't, and to your point that some banks should be losing money, because that means...
Well, I didn't say losing money. I said there should... If you have an entire country where there's not one losing loan, I think you're too stringent.
Sure. But I think banks are looking to do quite the opposite. I think they really want to protect their assets and make sure they have no loans that are defaulting or in a position where they're not going to generate higher revenue. And that's caused this problem. And without them really thinking, well, who does this really negatively impact? I think they're more focused on their bottom line and not thinking about anybody else.
I don't disagree. I just, but there were.
You know, back, just like, so I remember taking banking like 30 years ago and having one of those professors that liked to teach by making you think the wrong thing and then tell you that you're wrong. And explain why you're wrong. And he went through what you guys are talking about right now with respect to banks making loans and you know, making bad loans. And you know, he had a scenario where he had one loan officer that had no loans default, and another one that had maybe 3% of them default. And he was making an argument that the one that had a handful that were defaulting was probably taking on a proper amount of risk relative to what he was supposed to be doing for his job versus the one that never had a loss.
I would agree with that, by the way.
Yeah, so that's kind of, and you know, no bank wants to give a loan that, and what I'm kind of saying is you're both right. No bank wants to give a loan that's going to default, and it's not like they try to seek those out, but they do need, just like us in the investment industry, I mean, we're going to have losses.
Yeah.
And if we never have a loss, we're only going to be making the risk-free rate for people.
Right.
So there is, but again, you're not like, well, that's going to be the one that defaults. I don't think that the loan officers are ever thinking like that. But because they can now get capital in other ways to loan out, et cetera, it may be lower rates. And Larissa and I did a video and talked a little bit about this yesterday. You know, they don't have to be as aggressive with loans to get some capital to lend out like they used to. So if that's not, you know, the only source of funds, they can be less aggressive, and it probably is making it more difficult for average people that have a great business idea to get some capital.
Well, Russell, who's your buddy that went to jail, but he invented the junk bonds? Tell us his name. Yeah, with the bad toupee when he got to jail.
Oh, Milken.
Yeah.
And I love it. You know, you always say our people are buddies. You know, he and I hang out.
You know, I he was a brilliant man.
I'm kidding. No, he's a super brilliant man.
Until he kind of got...
And I love what he does now.
So, yeah, but he... Yeah. I mean, Larissa, I assume you know this, but for maybe the listeners that don't, what he invented was, at that time, you got to remember this, you either went to a bank that basically fleeced you, or you went to Salomon Brothers, who were still around, and they basically fleeced you. But that's where you went for capital, you know, to Morgans and those kind of guys. And what he did is he said, okay, we're going to try something new for the smaller companies. We're going to pay a higher rate of interest on these bonds, but we're not going to make you buy a bond in one company. We're going to package, like, say, 20 companies, mm-hmm. with the idea that probably one or two of them are not going to make it. But the difference in interest rate was like 3 or 4%, right, Russell? The difference in interest rate kind of covered it for you, and they would give you a package of say 20 companies, with the full intent, you know, or the full risk that maybe one or two are going to die along the way. And in fact, the companies that they selected, the amount that went under were way less than they had predicted. So they ended up being a really good investment. And I'm talking about very early on. But the Solomons of the world and the banks absolutely hated the idea that now there was a third way to get financing. And what they really were is they were non-investment grade, and those guys dumped the word junk on them. They weren't really junk. They were just not investment grade. And he put together a package, sort of like mortgages, and they did a really good job. But then the world, the investment world, hated the guy so much that they enticed him with what? Some sort of trading ahead of some information or something, Russell, and that's what put him in jail? But they were out for that guy because he essentially...
Yeah, no, and you know what they ended up putting Milken away for?
I thought it was for front-running or something.
No, they went after him all over country. And after I explain this, we need to go to break. We're going to end up not having a break if we don't.
We need one today.
I'm trying to help you. But Milken you would know this. You've got a lot of, and I'm sure you cross your I's and cross your T's and dot your I's and all that kind of crap. But honestly, it was for not filing a couple of forms. That, you know, they went through all of his paperwork and found a couple of things that he was supposed to do that he hadn't done. That the fine print is if you don't file this every year, it could be 2 years in jail. That's what they ended up getting him on.
Yeah, they went after him
just like Capone and tax evasion. Yeah. They got Milken on violation of security industry laws, but it was like maybe forgetting to. Do his personal training or update his license or something like that. In the scheme of things relative to what they think he did, what he ended up getting convicted on was pretty minor.
Well, let's continue this after the break, but they were out for him.
Go.
SP Futures, reason why I haven't pushed the break is like nothing's going on here before the Fed meeting. Go figure. SP Futures up 1, NASDAQ Futures down 15. Be right back.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years I've seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right here. Right now. Right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tamara Andrew on the board. Real quick here, because not much. It's a Fed morning here. SP futures up 1, NASDAQ futures down 16, so not much going on there. Over in Europe, we've got the Delivery Hero stock. Wow, they're the food delivery giant, Mull's Strategy. DAX down 113.5%, FTSE up 33.4%, CAC around down 18.2%, so kind of mixed, but not much there. Over in Asia, the Nikkei down 52, almost flat. Hang Seng up 106, that's 0.4%. Shanghai down 9.2%. I got to remember to ask Russell after the break why almost every day now the Hang Seng is one direction and Shanghai is the other. Bonds unchanged, 4.19 on the 10, maybe slightly up. The Bund 2.86, up 1 basis point. Oil, which is, boy, every day it's stuck on 59 or 60. Whoa, 58.37, so... If you're an oil trader right now, you haven't been doing very much. Gold, now 990, had a big run up yesterday. Silver is the one that's off the chart here. Silver up 84 cents, 61.68. That's got to be well into way past the hunting price. Foreign exchange, a steady at 116 on the euro, steady at 133 on the pound. Like I said, not much is moving. Crypto, which has been volatile, Today down 1,000 points, 92.114. It seems like this 90 to 92 here is like kind of the new range. We got for us real quick, traffic, weather, sports, raining out, it's crummy, it's early winter, it sucks.
Yeah, it's about all the excitement we got here. It's 7:38 here in Chicago, and it's December 10th. And yeah, barely, correct me if I'm wrong, not much going on in sports today.
No.
But yeah, over to weather. It's currently 37 degrees. It's going to be raining right now, but it's going to change to snow throughout the day as it gets a lot colder. We're going to have a high of 38, but possibly going down to about the mid-20s for the rest of the day. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 49 degrees. They're going to have sunny and pleasantly warm skies with a high of 76. And finally, for Chicago traffic, no accidents to report, and the expressways are looking about the usual. Just got some, you know, the usual traffic. So if you're coming in on the Kennedy from the Montreux, it's going to take about 30 minutes from O'Hare. Going to take you about 47. Eisenhower from Thorndale is going to take you about an hour. And basically the same for all the major expressways. About an hour either way, there or back. That's all I got. Back to you, Chief.
So, guys, they have, like, stages of life. I remember when it snowed when I was real young. Oh, God, get the guys over for tackle football in the snow. And when I got there a little older, I go, good, we're going skiing next week. Now it's like, watch out for the ice.
Yeah, that's what's going on now. Hey, just real quick, the hunts, silver went up to 198.
Wow.
Yeah, that tells you how ridiculous that was.
I remember the thing coming down the street, the Brinks truck.
Yeah, yeah. You know, my favorite part about that is, you know, they were going to take, they took all the silver to Europe. Down on their ranch, they had a sharpshooting contest with all the ranch hands, and the winners got to fly on the 747s with all the silver and shotguns to guard it.
What were the two bros' names? Was it Bunker, and what's the other guy's name?
Oh, I can't remember. I actually met one of their granddaughters once, and she was an interesting girl.
Andrew, look to see what the two Hunt brothers' names were. I know it was Bunker, and what the hell is the other guy's name? Oh. Andrew will find it. So what do you think of the Fed meeting today, Larissa? We've got all kinds of overtones with lame duck sort of status, and it's kind of interesting that he's out as chairman in May. He's got another year or two of a term. He could screw everybody and just not resign, I suppose, and that way he'd have to pick the new guy from on the board. But I don't think he'll do that. What do you make of all this?
You know, quite candidly, I don't know that a whole lot of things will happen that we're not anticipating.
What are you thinking? Quarter point?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll definitely get the quarter. Sorry, Larissa, I'm speaking over you, but we'll definitely get the quarter point today. And it's the odds of what's going to happen next year are just all over the place. But in addition to Powell being somewhat lame duck, this is the last voting meeting for four members, and there are four new members coming on. And I keep talking about this. I probably should do the actual work and tell you what the differences are. But my understanding is there's more uncertainty around the new voting members relative to the ones that are going off, to the point where there's one that thinks we shouldn't be doing anything. There's one that thinks maybe we should be a bit more worried about inflation and raising rates. And there's one that thinks we should be cutting more aggressively of those four. And one of the economists at Indiana pointed out at the presentations that I do, he could never find an instance where you had people dissenting in both directions on the Fed. And that right there, the clarity into 2026 is extremely, the VIX is pricing, and the VIX market is pricing today like we're going to get some sort of volatility event, or is braced for a volatility event relative to how volatility behaves normally in December. So we shall, it's not going to be the quarter point. It's probably not going to be much of the statement. It's going to be the anticipation from the new voting members versus the old voting members. And what's is Powell going to stick with chair through May, or are they going to go ahead and with the four new voting members, are they going to do something different as well? I doubt it on that. I think he'll just wait out his term.
What to explain? And you probably know better than me. There's the when I don't know who's who, but maybe you do. The only spot that is always a voting member is the Federal Reserve in New York, correct?
That, yep. And the chair.
And the chair. So then you've got eight other people that flip on for, is it a year or 2 years that they vote? They're all at the meeting, but only four get to vote. They all get to participate, but four get to vote and the other four don't. And then is that a year or 2 year thing?
Well, there's 12 total. So eight of the 12 vote.
Okay,
right, but I think their terms are 2 year terms. If I'm
2 year voting terms, okay.
I think
as much as I've discussed this with people, I really probably should have spent 15 minutes looking at the actual when these things rotate in and out.
Well, the external people, of which there are four, they always vote. They always vote. But then there's eight Federal Reserve banks. The president of that bank, four of those vote at a time, not all eight, right? So the chairman always votes, the Federal Reserve Bank.
There's 12. I thought there were 12, but there's 12 banks, and I thought eight of the 12 voted, and then there were four permanent members in the chair. That's what I thought.
Okay, well, next week we'll dig through this. Yeah. Because, I know the New York guy always gets to vote.
Yeah.
Because, see, there's the guys that allegedly... They would do all the money supply work, but I think a lot of that now is done from Chicago, isn't it? Or didn't you recently a lot of it's done from here?
I don't know about I don't know.
Because it was always the New York people that bought the bonds and sold the bonds, but I think the Chicago group has taken over some of that. I don't know why. I haven't seen, since those guys don't come to work anymore, I don't get to meet them, which is kind of weird. But anyway, that's where that all goes. But what do you in the class you're teaching, Larissa, the hook here seems to be in the party line, for years, not just because the current administration, has been if they lower rates, somehow it benefits everybody. And yet my research is your credit card rate is not about to go down a quarter point today because these guys lowered the rate. Maybe if it affects the 10-year, the mortgage might move, but it clearly does not drop. I mean, we went from a period of, 4.5%, 5% down to zero. In that 10-year period, I had the credit card rates going up. So the idea that this sort of helps every man, and the politicians will all say that. I mean, Trump will say that today. It's going to help everybody. Well, it doesn't. I mean, how do they pull that off? I mean, there's a website where if you go back, it'll say historical credit card rates. There's one of them I found. Of course, I probably lost it. Not only would it tell you the rate, but it would have the same time it would have you the rate of what the risk-free rate was and the spread between the two. And the last time I looked was a couple months ago. We're at the absolute maximum, or have been, and what the spread is between like a risk-free loan. And the difference between a credit card interest rate and a regular one is like 10% or 15% or something. It's huge. I mean, how do these guys pull that off? Is it just because it's a cartel or what?
Well, I also think it comes back to credit quality. So we're in a situation where people are struggling to pay credit cards. We have substantial credit card debt happening, and we have delinquency on credit cards. I'm not saying that this is the right thing to do, but I believe that's part of their justification for charging these really high rates for credit cards. Because if you're looking at a higher probability of default, that's what justifies charging higher interest rates.
Well, who gets to make this group? I mean, I guess my question is, if in a normal world, which we're supposed to be in, you don't pay 25% for your mortgage because in some city they gave out mortgages to people that didn't even have a job, and you get to be essentially graded on not just yourself but your group. Why am I graded with, one of the guys from the Fed told me one night, he goes, you have no idea how big these how much they charge off. And I said, okay, wait a minute. The guy's name was John. I go, John, are we talking about a guy like Russell, which he would never do, goes out and buys furniture knowing he sort of can't pay for it and then reneges on it? Or are we talking about the price of the furniture, or are we talking about the interest rate they lob on that, plus the fees, plus the attorney's fees and all the other crap for the next 2 years before they charge it off? He goes, well, you got me there. It's probably
the big number, not the other number.
It's the big number. Yeah. Which, yeah. You know, my wife always likes to say that, you know, you shouldn't be paying interest on a potato that you bought 3 years ago. But let's say I go to Whole Foods, which is expensive, and I buy a potato for $5 and I never make my credit card payments, you know, that could be $100 potato.
Yeah.
But it only costs the bank $5.
Right. That's my point. How does anybody even,
you know,
but how much, you know, I mentioned yesterday, and I was kind of wishing you guys were on because you're closer to this. If you look around, you can actually find credit card rates that are a lot lower. But I think
we are.
I think people, it's just me, I'm asking the question. I think people get lobbed into the money back, never thinking they're not going to make the payment. And all of a sudden, one day, you have a medical event or, what'd you say that transmission was? $10,000? What do you mean $10,000 for a transmission? I mean, so all of a sudden something like that happens, and all of a sudden there you are. But there's a lot of credit unions around. You get a rate for 8% if you want.
Yeah, I think part of it is people don't make the effort to. We talked about the instructor at SIBO that always liked to ask the China group, so what they were going to do about Taiwan.
I love that.
He was great with personal finance. I'm terrible with it, but he was great with it. He actually had he figured out he could take a second mortgage on an apartment that he had, a condo that he had downtown, and pay 3% on it, and take the money and put it in a CD that paid 4%. I mean, he was finding things like that all the time. If more people did that, credit card rates would be lower.
Yeah, well, I think people get,
you know what I mean? We get a solicitation every other day. My daughters are getting them now, you know. Which is kind of interesting. Maggie's getting them, and Emmy, and I think Emmy actually just got one, which is a little bit frightening. Although they gave me a credit card back in the day, and eventually they probably made a fortune off of me the way I used it in college.
Russell, I really like your idea, though, about if people were better educated about their credit cards and how to find other little pockets of financing, that it would start to drive the industry as opposed to the industry driving consumers.
And where that thought actually came from was, Chief, a little bit earlier, you said, you know, well, who's driving the rates? Who's setting the rate? It's a market forces thing. And the problem is the consumer is terrible about their role in that, you know, in setting that rate.
Would you consider
they're willing to accept a really terrible, terrible rate. The only time that I've ever had a card that had a really bad rate on it, it would be like my backup card, and I would always pay it and make sure, and I knew I was going to pay it off immediately. And what I mean by backup card is, you know, if the other one's not working, or, you know, I've had more than one instance where I'm traveling internationally and I've tried to use the card a couple of too many times and they suddenly put a block on it. I do have a high interest rate card, but I think the balance has never gotten above $300 or $400.
Well, you don't even check because you're not going to use it.
I'm not worried about that one, but yeah, I mean, but the majority of my purchases, if I know, and it's funny you mentioned the $10,000 transmission. I ended up in a little bit of a screwed up situation with a credit card for a couple of months because our basement flooded.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Wow.
Yeah. It's just surprises like that, and that's one of the reasons that it's kind of nice to have those. You can take care of things like that very quickly, but it does cost. But that convenience is going to cost you.
Well, that's what this current inflation thing right now is, and it's nothing like I've ever seen in my lifetime. And I went through this stuff in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
Now I think people have somehow come to manage, you know, to their best of their ability, what everybody's always talking about, the price of gasoline and the price of the food store. I mean, people have permanently ducked away from beef and gotten onto chicken and pork. I mean, because beef is so much more expensive now than the other. I think they've made those kinds of moves, but I think if you were to put a list down of the average American and say, what if you needed a transmission? What if somebody scratched your bumper? What if you needed a new air conditioner? What if you needed a new roof? I don't think the average person gets an F on that. I don't even think you get to an F on that paper. I don't think they have any idea, unless you have a friend that just went through it, what those lurking inflation numbers are. If you, unless you hit them, God help it, it's an emergency room visit. I think those things are lurking out there, and most of us, thank God, have not stumbled upon them yet. But one of these days, you know, you will. I mean, you see it. Listen, we have on Monday we have Audrey or Nancy in, and Audrey's in real estate and Nancy's in mortgage, and you know they work together a lot. And all they talk about is how when somebody buys a house now, they, especially first time buyer, you absolutely make sure that nothing's wrong with the place. Not because you're some lazy guy now who doesn't know how to use a screwdriver. It's because every nickel you have is going toward the mortgage. It has nothing to do with being lazy. By the way, I heard on the way in this morning, and I should have dug it up, that the amount now you need to buy an entry-level house now, you need to make $117,000 a year or something.
Ooh. Yeah, I know it was seven or six figures.
Yeah, it's . And you know, I still have. Well, I don't because I think I lost it. I had a piece of paper on here, and I would I would have a discussion with my significant other, who was in real estate, the lovely Audrey. And back in 2007, some guy wrote an article saying, "Well, you know, here's where the average house then I think was." Was it, where was he, you think it was? 235, maybe, Russell? Somewhere in there.
Yeah.
That if somebody gave you 20% down, so now you're talking about a mortgage of, say, 190, you needed $85,000. This is before the insurance went up, before the tax went up. You need $85,000 to afford that house. And the guy walked through all the levels of people, said if you worked in essentially a cubicle downtown, you made $40,000. If you worked in restaurants, you made 20, and if you worked in a hospital, not a doctor, you made like 65. So his conclusion was 85% of the population did not make the $85,000 you needed to afford that house. And it wasn't like a year later, you know, with all the stuff happened in 2007, 2008, that people still to this day blame on the wrong people getting the wrong mortgages, and nobody looks at the price level and how the population couldn't possibly, on a whole, afford it. And I'm going to say that number today is way worse. And what this week, was it Monday, Russ? I almost called you on this. It came out that the average person that works in any kind of retail makes half of what you need to rent a normal apartment.
I can see that.
It's not even close. It's half.
Yeah.
I don't know what it's like, you know, Indianapolis has got to be like Chicago, but I don't know what it's like in where you're at, Larissa. It's probably a little better, but they're saying the average person who works retail makes like $30,000 or $35,000 a year, and in order to rent an apartment now, they want you to make three times the rent, right? So if the rent's $2,000, they want you making six. Well, six times 12 is 72, which is double the 36, right? I mean, yeah. The math is easy. I mean, how are we going to deal with this going forward? I don't want to see some sort of crash, but it seems like somehow or another these prices got to come back down. How old is the cars we going to be driving, guys? 50 years old? We look like Havana, for God's sake? I mean, who can afford a new one?
You're 6 years of financing now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I remember growing up, I think the longest car loans you could really get was 4 years.
Well, they were three for a while, and then they were four, then they were five.
Yeah, but I mean, and when you take, you know, when you take out a 30-year mortgage on a house, I don't know what percentage actually get paid off. You know, people actually stay in the house for 30 years. But the idea is that, you know, the loan is going to be lower than the value of the house at some point. I get, you know, that's probably what people are thinking with their car is, you know, in 4 years, I can trade it in, pay off what's remaining on the loan and have a little bit toward the next car as opposed to actually paying it off.
Well, you surely don't want your payments to go further than your warranty. That's suicide.
Yeah, exactly. They go, well, and then they, you know, they, after 3 years, they come at you and they want to sell you a warranty.
Yeah.
That's probably the point when you want to trade the car in.
So, Larissa, how many? I assume you're doing well. You're a professor, but when? Not asking anything personal here, but you and the other people that you do, you know, you work with. What are the chances of one of those people walking into their car place this weekend, seeing one for 100 Jeezels and walking and driving that thing home? I can't imagine doing that. Even if I could pay it cash, 100 grand for a car? What am I talking about, for God's sake? It better come with a driver.
Yeah, I don't think that's happening in West Lafayette.
That happens in my neighborhood.
Yeah,
boy, that was a really arrogant thing to say. Not by me, but by some of my neighbors, that happens out where I live. So how's that?
Well,
I don't even know that we have dealers where you can buy those types of cars in West Lafayette.
I know where the closest Porsche dealership is to you.
Okay, great.
Wait a minute, you don't have to go.
It's not there.
What do you think that the high end Jeep is? It's 100 grand.
They're close. They really are.
Yeah.
That's where I get a bit amazed. And I like just looking at cars. And there was an article I got yesterday. It was 500 horsepower plus cars under $100,000. And you know, it was just more powerful normal cars that you wouldn't even nod your head at on the road that were like $70,000 and $80,000.
That's
like a pickup truck with a Hemi is $90,000.
Oh yeah, yeah. They're in the
not that you need that, but still.
Well, can you buy with the COVID, when they with the supply chain shortages and all that stuff? Whenever you drive by a place, I like trucks. You could never see a regular truck. Every one of them was all tricked out. You weren't going to put the. I'm going to say at the end of the 2008 recession or 2009. When they had all, there was problems. People were having problems selling stuff. At one point, you could get, and again, this is a one-day deal or one-month deal, you could get a Ford 150, just your base model, your regular single cab and that whole bit. I think you could get one of those things. I don't think it was four-wheel drive in the 17,000-18,000 range. First of all, if you can find one now, it's got to be 55 or 45, somewhere in there. If you can find one. I mean, that's a long way in 17 years. I mean, it's way different than your CPI. I mean, it's not even...
It's most definitely different than the CPI.
All right, we got a couple of minutes because we started a little late. What's the story with all the numbers? Can we believe them? I mean, last week we're waiting all week for the PCE. Why would anybody wait for the PCE? Nobody gets any detail on it. Nobody knows where it comes from. What does that number even tell anybody? What about the labor numbers that are be coming out in the 16th, supposedly? And what about the CPI this month? Can we believe any of this stuff? Could we ever?
Well, we couldn't in the past, and I think there's a lot more volatility around the numbers because, the collection methodology can't be consistent with people, being furloughed. So not a great answer, but there are certain things that I do in the consulting work that I do that are based on how the market reacts around economic numbers, and I've just stopped doing that.
Really?
Because I just stopped putting out projections and everything, just because I can't with any certainty guess what's going to happen. And it's different than when we get the normal scheduled numbers. I don't know what's going on in the background with the methodology. I know everything that gets done behind the scenes in government has been cut back. I know it's a different topic, but I've got the daughter with meteorology. The National Weather Service, due to budget cuts, has cut back from two weather balloons a day to one in all of their areas, and the weather predictions have been less accurate since they did that. You've got to assume that same mentality bleeds over to the economic numbers, that there are fewer people calculating these things. It was already an overwhelming job on a month-to-month basis, and what we're probably getting are best guesses. We're always getting best guesses, but we're getting worse best guesses relative to what we used to get.
Well, hey, you mentioned
and the so VIX. I'm sidelining until next year with respect to trading around an economic number.
Well, you mentioned the VIX. And this is I don't know if this is good for a class, Larissa, but we at PTI have, because we're good at it to the extent anybody can be really good at it. We're really good at, and we will take and you know, high concentration issues, and we're an attempt to hedge them. Obviously, with a every person's different, so you do different for different people. I have never, on a stock by stock basis, Russell, I've never paid so much for puts. I mean, our whole strength for 30 years of doing this is we had always had a fighting chance of covering the put cost by doing something on the call side. And between the interest rates being low, which obviously kicks puts up and calls down, it is really difficult to do this for free for somebody where we ought to be able, you know, we used to be able to do it. And yet the stuff is so high, people want protection. You got to give it to them, and you got to do just the best you can and be very nimble. But I mean, we're really good at it, and we're struggling to do this for free.
There's a structural change in the market due to the increased participation of like pro/retail traders who really like selling calls and selling call spreads, and it has suppressed the implied vol on the call side of the equation across a lot of U.S. stocks, and definitely across like the SPX, NDX, and RUT, and the Russell 2000 indexes. But you're witnessing that on the stock side, where there's just so much there's extra selling pressure relative to history on out of the money calls, just coming from systematic institutional sellers, as well as, you know, individuals looking at ways to pick up, you know, try to pick up returns through selling calls against their stocks. Plus, at the market top, there are a lot of people that are more comfortable selling calls.
Yeah.
You know, thinking how much farther we can go. So you're just seeing that manifest itself in not being able to put on collars at attractive prices.
Well, plus if you, I mean, real quick, and we just hope we're not boring you, but say a talk like Meta. Meta is one we don't have, so I can talk about it. It's trading 650. It's down 610 this morning. Well, if the price of the puts or the calls, but say the puts, get expensive, if the market you thought was valued, you know, somewhat normally or even cheap, you might say, I don't really need to buy the 650 put flat outright. I can buy the 650 and sell like the 610, you know, and I'll buy some insurance for that $40 piece. But right now, I'm not so sure that if something crazy happens or all of a sudden, you know, we have to raise taxes because we're broke or something like that, I don't think I could put a stop at Meta at 610 if things start to go bad. I don't know if it'll just blow right through it. You know, it's sort of like insuring your car, saying, well, my car's worth 50, but if I get an accident, I'm really not going to total a whole car. I'm only going to, you know, dent a fender and it's $5,000. I'll only get $10,000 worth of insurance. Well, good luck with that. I mean, you know, I hope it works for you, but it may not, right?
Yeah.
Sort of the same deal.
So you guys know, I'm thoroughly enjoying this. I just had my students do a project where they had to create a structured product, and most of them did a collar. And it's been entertaining watching them go through prices and pick strike prices and figure out exactly how much insurance they were going to get. But I'm also entertained. I don't think that my students actually believe that people do this.
Well, yeah, they do. Yeah, they do.
So this has been, I've thoroughly enjoyed this.
Well, last gasp here. What people don't really look at, and I wouldn't on a daily basis either, but interest rates for a long period of time have not been part of any of the discussion regarding options. Yet they are a big piece of it if they ever really change. And when interest rates were like 10%, means your calls go way up and your puts go way down, right, Russell? Well, sometimes if a stock was 90, you could like buy the 85 puts, sell like the 105 calls for even. And you sit there, well, that's not a bad do. Most I can lose is 5 and I can make 15 or 10. I'll do that all day long. You can't do that now. The puts are more expensive than the calls, which again makes it more difficult, right? In addition to the VIX being high. So there's some of these other variables come into play every once in a while, don't they, Russell?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, they absolutely do. It's really fun to watch, you know, fun from an academic standpoint, just to watch how things shift a bit just based on, you know, different ways to trade becoming more attractive and less attractive. Well, and right now, these buffer type, you know, these buffered outcome ETFs, where you're, you know, you're going to limit some of the downside, but you're also going to limit some upside. They're pretty popular, but when people buy these things, they result in option selling.
Yeah.
And it's suppressing implied volatility. Believe it or not, man, if you had bought a one-day straddle on the NASDAQ every day on the close and held it to the next day close this year, you'd have done pretty well.
Yeah.
And that's not how it's supposed to work.
If you'd have bought the straddle in virtually every earnings this year, you'd have been up money. It's got to be the only year ever you could have done
and that. And I've run tests on that historically, and typically over you know, a 1 year time period, you just about break even.
Yep. Well, you should if the market's active.
Yeah, the market's generally very efficient. The point is that the market is really efficient with respect to options pricing around earnings. But there are periods where it seems to be a bit mispriced, and this has been one of those years. And I think it's all these short dated options and people trying to take advantage of selling them.
Well, guys, we got a dash. This has been terrific as usual. Both of you guys, doesn't it seem like it's gonna be a long way to April with what we're going through here? Is it just me?
Yeah.
This is too early.
You're
for
talking
this.
About
the weather.
Yeah, once a decade, once every 15 years, we get just a brutal, brutal winter in Chicago. Welcome to a brutal winter.
It was predicted, you know, by Stacks and Jacks.
I know. Yeah. It was predicted by Ben Franklin as well.
Oh, God. Larissa, take care. Russell, take care. Talk to you guys next week. SP Futures down 5. NASDAQ Futures down 41. We're leaking a little, but not very much. Fed meeting today. Tell all about it tomorrow.
That's all, folks.